I'll be honest, this summer is stacked. Between that one big international soccer tournament, America's 250th anniversary, and the Route 66 centennial, people are going to be traveling. What a lot of folks don't realize is that taking a trip in an RV is a whole heck of a lot more enjoyable than TSA lines or stodgy hotels. And you don't even have to own an RV or drive one to take part. With Outdoorsy, you can rent an RV or camper almost anywhere in the country. You can drive it, tow it, or have it delivered and set up for you. And these aren't bare-bones setups. Many come with full kitchens, bathrooms, showers, and real beds. It's often more affordable than hotels, especially for families or groups. And everything includes insurance, 24/7 support, and roadside assistance. If you're thinking about a summer trip, or just planning ahead for the rest of 2026, get 10% off when you book using promo code OUTDOORSY2026. Head to OUTDOORSY.com. That's OUTDOORSY.com, promo code OUTDOORSY2026.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses for a limited time. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
Hello, White Sox fans, and welcome to the Future Sox podcast, part of the Just Baseball Media Network. My name is Ian Eskridge. Joining me, as always, Mr. James Fox. Tonight, we'll be getting into some of the promotions that have been happening, a couple of injuries, draft strategy on drafting a shortstop, which has been a thing as of late, you know, four or five times here, going to probably be after this draft. Also, in the second half of the stream here, we'll have Jeff Ellis from Lockdown Guardians. Also covers the MLB draft like no other. How you doing, James?
Good, man. What's going on?
Well, I was hoping for a sweep today.
Yeah.
Almost got it, but
it was almost the Derek Hill game. Yes.
It was. All right, so I have a question for you. All right, so Derek Hill hit a home run.
Yes.
So the ninth inning comes up for Corn Boy comes out to get the save. They pinch hit for him with Edgar Carroll, but then they let Acuna hit.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, so apparently I saw somewhere on Twitter that Hayes, like, wasn't available. Where he has, like, some side soreness or something. I don't know if he was the only one left. Like, who else? Did they have anybody else? I feel like he would have been maybe the only guy that they had available. So, whatever. Like, maybe they mismanaged their bench. Like, because that was...
I just felt like I would rather see Hill hit than Acuna hit.
Yeah.
And, like, if Carroll gets out, you're going to see Acuna... But the odds of Carroll probably catching up to 102 miles an hour up in the zone was probably pretty small anyway with the way he's been hitting. Granted, he's been improving as of late, but I know 100% that Acuna was never going to touch any of those three pitches. There's just no way.
Yeah, it was like, if you have like the high school pitcher like pitch to fifth graders, that's like kind of what it looked like. It's like not great.
Exactly. It's like you're going up against your 7-year-old nephew in the backyard.
Yes, and you're throwing him heaters. Like, yeah.
And you're actually like trying to get him out. Yeah, there's just no shot. It was pretty rough. Other than that, there's been a bunch of pleasant developments. I mean, the fact that people are tweeting about the White Sox saying, hey, the White Sox are almost at 500.
Yeah. In a horrible division. My goodness gracious, is it bad? But no, I mean, look, I know everybody, it's like in vogue, right, to like talk about the bunting. They're bunting all the time, right? Jesus, they're bunting a lot, but I mean, they're hitting a ton of bombs and their starting pitching's good. That's why they're decent.
Yeah. I mean, you still have the bad players on the roster. Well, I mean, not even necessarily bad, just guys that you don't plan on having here for a long time. You know, the Hill, the Peters, probably Kelenic, who finally got a hit and then managed to get picked off of first base.
Yeah, rough play.
Yeah, there's a couple of guys there that are, and you know, and the thing is that they're actually making halfway, like Peters plays nice center field defense. He got a hit in the ninth inning there when all looked lost. Yeah, I don't know. Even though they're not guys that you plan on having around for a long time, they're still like acting like baseball players every once in a while, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it'll look better if Teal ever returns and you can add Teal and Braden Montgomery for two of the guys that you're talking about, it'll look a lot better, I think, or at least a lot more fun.
Speaking of, we can get into this a little bit more later, but if you are, if you have your head buried in the sand or you're living under a rock, Braden Montgomery is moving his self up to AAA to start this next coming week on Cinco de Mayo. So that's interesting stuff.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if the Sox just like from now on send a press release to their beat reporters so that we don't get any of these signings, so that we don't get any of these anymore in front of people that actually cover the team for a living. I suspect that they're going to like tell the media before they even tell the players from now on.
I mean, that's entirely possible. It's kind of one of those things. They probably send the text to the beat reporter as the guy's walking into the office.
I know. Yeah.
He can't see it on the internet before he walks into the room.
Yeah. No, the White Sox announced Braden's today. So, but no, that's good. He starts off on the road, I believe. Right. How long do you think this is? Because I actually like chatted with Scott Merkin for a little bit today, and he said that he thought it would be like a month or whatever, but then he had other guys in the press box that were kind of talking about it that thought like maybe July, like they did with Colson. I just think it's totally, I think if he goes to Charlotte and hits like 8 homers in a week, like, you know, everybody's just going to kind of be like, okay, like, what are we doing here? Like, this doesn't really, because, I mean, like, he might struggle a little bit with, like, some of the craftier type guys, but, like, playing in those ballparks, like, if he hits anything in the air, like, these are going to be fun homers.
Yeah, I think that it's, you're at the mercy of the parks for the results, but I kind of feel like they're not going to necessarily judge his performance based upon the results, because hitting in the International League is one of those things where if a guy gets a ball up in the air in Charlotte, but you don't have to do a whole lot. I mean,
yeah, Exhibit A, now, Jacob Gonzalez right now.
I mean, he's and got look, 9 home runs.
And like the swing looks better. Like he looks better.
Yeah.
But if you look at the splits, like you can't tell me that it like doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, he hit a grand slam the other night with a 94-mile-an-hour exit velocity. And, I mean, granted, it traveled. I just don't know what that's gonna look like in Chicago in May and June. And I said to Dylan
For Gonzalez, you're saying?
Yeah. You know, I told him to look out for this because I don't see him getting called up before the draft, before the deadline. I see him as being the guy that they give late July, early August ABs to. And you could see him pop off in Chicago in those particular months because the ball tends to travel a little bit farther in those particular months. But I kind of feel like you'd see, you know, everybody would say, oh, well, you know, they finally figured out the holes in his swings in September, when in reality, it just means that the 94-mile-an-hour exit velocities are not carrying out of the park or not carrying, you know, to the wall or just falling in general.
Maybe you just let him hit 20 homers in Charlotte and see if anybody that liked him pre-draft still likes him enough to trade something for him. Because, I mean, what, even for the Sox, he's part of a infield mix that plays sometimes, you know, like it's not like he's I don't think they're counting on him to, you know, beat out Mydroth or Antonacci anytime soon. That was cool today, seeing Antonacci lead off. Maybe just keep him there.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like that's... I will say this, though. We've been thinking that he should be doing that since the get, but we're also expecting an awful lot for a guy that is just coming into Major League Baseball to expect him to be able to lead off. I mean, that's a very pressure-packed...
Oh, place. I get not doing it right away.
Yeah.
I just think now they can, if they want.
Yeah, I think so. I think he's comfortable enough, or getting comfortable enough, that he can do that and be okay.
Yeah. No, I think it's... Yeah, I think it's fine. I think, you know, that'll be cool. Braden and Charlotte, I think, what, there was Shane Murphy's going there, too, to help a ravaged, ailing pitching staff, like, in Charlotte. David Sandlin's there, too. He's pretty good. Maybe David Sandlin beats these other guys to the majors now. The guys, I mean, obviously, like, we'll get into Tanner, you know. Yeah. We're going to get into Hagen, too, because I feel like yelling on a podcast. But, I mean, you know, David Sandlin at this point, if he's healthy, I mean, there really isn't anything holding him back. I mean, he's basically major league ready.
Yeah, so he went and did two rehab starts in Winston-Salem. The walks were a little bit up there for my liking in Winston-Salem. I kind of felt like there was a little bit too much wasted pitches. But then again, he had not been throwing for a while. So shouldn't have really been all that surprising, I suppose. But now when he pitched for the first time in Charlotte, he went four innings and the pitch count was down. Not a whole lot of wasted pitches, just getting outs. And he looked pretty good. And to be able to throw four scoreless innings in Charlotte in and of itself is a feat of valor.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So let's get into this Hagen thing, because I know that, you know, I tweeted about it earlier today. Stop asking us why he's only pitching three innings. And I mean, we've been literally saying this since the beginning of the season. So, like, we're going on a month now of me seeing these questions of why is he only throwing three innings? When's he going to start throwing more than three innings? The White Sox are doing this on purpose. Now, I agree with you on your thoughts here, but why don't you go ahead and throw them out for everybody here?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, like, I'm just, like, done with this whole thing. Like, I know, like, there, I think there's been some really good in the Brian Bannister, like, era. I think there's also been some stuff that, like, I'm pretty puzzled by. This is, like, one of them. I understand last year, you know, like, he didn't look right, you know, and he was sent down and they fixed him or whatever, and they were, like, kind of, like, nursing him back, right? I also understand the late start in spring training, and I understand you wanting him to finish, like, full go in Chicago, right? I get all that. I just, like, think it's time for this kid to, like, I just don't care. Like, I, you know, and I got some pushback on Twitter because, like, look, the velo drop thing is, like, still happening a little bit, and the walks are there. Like, he's always going to walk people. Like, you know, like, when you hear the White Sox talk about him, and I heard Yanish this week, I think, with Connor McKnight, they talk about this guy like he's this, like, fiery competitor that's, like, a future ace that just, like, wants to kill people. Like, but then they let him throw, like, 48 pitches every week.
Yeah, but then, like, he's a fragile flower when it comes, like, to actually throwing pitches.
It just, like, it doesn't make any sense to me, right? And people were like, oh, he can't throw three innings in the majors. It'll kill your bullpen. Like, no, I agree with that part. Just call him up, put him in the rotation, and treat him like you're treating Schultz. Like, he can go five innings. Like, this guy was a ace at Arkansas in the SEC, and we're like acting like he's a high school guy. I'm not even like considering who they passed on to take him. Like, they gave him $8 million. Like, what are we doing? Like, why did, like, the kid gloves are insane for this dude. I just don't understand.
So there are reasonable questions here. That, and this one's the one that I think that needs to be addressed, which Jimmy brings up Hagen's velo. And that is a reasonable question. It goes in my brain, and the first thing I think of is usually when a guy's trying to throw strikes and not walk somebody, the velo is going to go down a little bit because they're trying to be a little bit more free and easy just over the plate. But it is a reasonable concern where he's starting at 97, which we, you know, when he was in college, he was throwing 98, 99 miles an hour. Now he's throwing 97 out of the gate. And then every inning, it continues to drop a couple of miles an hour. And it is concerning. It's kind of one of those things where you wonder what's going on there. And I don't know if this is something that they're telling him to do. Just go ahead and throw, you know, go out there and throw 90%. We literally just want you to get your pitches in.
Well, they don't seem concerned about it.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, even like last year, like, I feel like this happened last year, obviously, and like alarm bells went off and like you led the charge on it. And like, I feel like it's a little bit different this time just because like he's still getting people out. Like, he looks fine. He didn't look fine last year.
That is true.
You know, like, this is like, okay, like, yeah, it's like 93, like, that's not great, but like, it's not like guys, teams are killing him, you know? So,
yeah.
I kind of just, I mean, like, I want to see him with the big league coaching staff and just see, yeah, like, what it looks like.
I think the difference last year also is that you weren't seeing those 97s right out of the gate. You were seeing like 93 out of the gate.
Right. And then he's throwing 90 and it's like,
and
oh
then
boy,
he's
like, yeah,
and then
this?
He's hitting 89 in his last inning and you're sitting there going, what is going on here? I'm going to get to this super chat here from Enrique before it slips my mind, because it will.
Mm-hmm.
He says, when Teal comes back, will we send Caro to the minors or will they send him to Arizona with Ryan Fuller, just like Colson Montgomery last year? And this comes with the emergence of
Drew Romo,
who just knocking the cover off the ball.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I do think there's something to be said for the fact that like Drew Romo is probably more equipped to be a backup than Caro is, right? So, like, if you think Caro going down for whatever the time being to play every day like will help him, then I think it's probably worthwhile. I mean, Teal will probably get the majority of the time against righties. So if you think, you know, Romo is better suited to play part time than Caro is, like, I think we could see that. I just don't know that, like, Teal's ever coming back. Like, I don't know when that's happening. Like, we haven't even heard about a rehab stint. So I'm kind of hoping that all of a sudden we hear that, you know, Teal is, you know, in Charlotte or in Birmingham, like, rehabbing this week. I think that would be a really good sign, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we can sit here and talk about this situation until we're blue in the face, but until Teal actually makes his way to a rehab assignment and they deem him ready to actually take some at bats somewhere and actually try and stretch a double or something like that, it really doesn't matter about this at all.
Yeah. I will say one smaller thing here, and Kevin brought up, like, yeah, Romo's the better defensive profile. His knock was he wasn't supposed to hit. This dude was a 35th pick overall in the draft out of high school. And we've talked about it some, but not a ton. Like, catchers are weird. Catchers take forever. And like, development is not linear thing is very true for catcher profiles, right? So this guy was good enough to be a top 40 pick. You know, this was like a good prospect. And Colorado gave up on him, and it's like a notoriously bad organization, like, for hitting, you know? So, like, is there a chance that the White Sox, like found something here? Sure. Like, you know, it's probably a backup, right? But I think it's a really good backup. And I think he's, you know, I think it's similar to Miguel Vargas and, you know, like Pereira and Acuna and Meade. And look, obviously, like, for Meade, it didn't work out. And Acuna's not looking very good. But, I mean, some of these post-hype guys, you know, like Miguel Vargas might be a core member of your team. And, I mean, Everson Pereira, I he's been hurt twice now. I kind of like him too, though, especially when, you know, when you gave up Steven Wilson, you know, essentially for him. So, Yoenis Gomez, who just got DFA'd, that was the other part of that trade. So I think that's like a good one too.
He's going to make his way back.
I tweeted that yesterday. Did you see?
Yeah. I mean,
I said, are the White Sox going to claim? Well, so he's been horrible. But is it as simple as, like, he comes back here and Brian Bannister does the Bannister thing? Right. He's like, no, what are you doing? Do this instead. Be the good version of yourself.
All right. So I'm going to bring this up here. Super chat from PJB Rankin. Cheers, guys. Long-time podcast listener. It's my first time getting to stop by live. You do great work. We appreciate you.
Thank you, sir.
For popping in.
Appreciate it.
So this is something that has been asked quite a few times, and I don't know the answer, but did the bat speed training screw Caro up, considering his name is slapping the ball?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, I thought Caro had 20-plus home run power watching him in the minors.
I did, too.
And then he came up, and it was like one of these things where it's like he destroyed lefties. You know, his left-handed swing wasn't great. Again, I literally just talked about this with Drew Romo. Caro's super young still. Catchers are weird, man. Like, it's just, like, he was ready to come up. It's not like one of these things where it's like, oh, they should have kept him in Charlotte longer. Like, no, he earned his big league spot, right? But that doesn't mean he's going to come up and be good, because baseball's hard. So, yeah. Again, like, it's just, you know, one of those things. I don't think they were expecting to have to count on him this much. He had a really rough start. So, we'll see. I think Edgar Caro's still, like, a big part of the future in some capacity somewhere, you know. I mean, look, they could trade Edgar Caro at some point, whatever, right? But I just, yeah, I think more time is probably necessary here. But it was funny that, like, there were, like, multiple articles written about, you know, the driveline stuff or whatever he was going to do, and he looks like, you know, kind of in a rough spot.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like it actually benefited him in any shape or form. Old Cole Tony here asks if there's a chance Caro ends up like Henry Davis, just in there for certain pitches. I don't think so, because, I mean, the reason why you do that is because what Kev says here, which he says, could Romo be the best defensive catcher on the team, even with Teal? And Teal really didn't catch that much. So notwithstanding here, because I think that Teal's arm is
yeah, I don't think Teal, good, I don't but, think Teal's that good defensively.
I don't either. So I think that Romo is definitely the best defensive catcher here. I think it's one of those things where you have to let him learn his staff a little bit better to get more comfortable. So hopefully you don't see those pass balls like happened in the ninth inning today.
Yeah, the thing with Teal is he's going to be like a plus offensive player with like 20 homers at catcher. That's what makes Teal appeal. I mean, he's fine defensively, but I don't think we were ever going to say, like, oh, Teal's, like, this great defender, like, by any means. I mean, he really hasn't caught that much. You know, I mean, he caught some in high school, and then he didn't even catch that much at Virginia. So it's just, he's kind of a work in progress, too. He's just such a good offensive player that he was, like, you know, he's, like, definitely part of the core.
That is a great question, baseball. He asked, do we ever see Michael Turner? And I say, I hope so, because I enjoy his game. He's a professional, and I dig that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's possible. I mean, they have their three catchers, like, right now. Von Lackey it is. Yeah.
It is not Adrian. I'm sorry.
That's very
funny. We'll get to that draft stuff in a little while when Jeff hops on here. But one thing I did want to talk about, and it's something that we haven't really – I mean, we've talked about it in spurts here and there, but I kind of wanted to pick your brain. When we look at Hagen Smith, when we look at Grant Taylor, when we look at the way that they're deploying these pitchers, all, and this is all through the org. Now, I know that they do things a lot of the time, you know, if there's a massive pitch count, discrepancy, the innings go down. But generally what they try and do is they try and do ups and downs, and you'll get an extra if you've only thrown like minuscule amount of pitches. And this is what happened with Hagen when he got his fourth inning the other week. You know, when you see Grant Taylor out there and he throws an 8-pitch inning and then he doesn't come out for a second inning because they're talking about, oh, well, he's only scheduled to have one up and down today. At what point, if you are talking about working him into a starter's load, how many, you know, how can you take away these ups and downs and not allow him to get more innings per week if you're trying to build up his stamina?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good question. Like, I wonder if with Taylor, it's just one of those things where they have like an inning load that they want to hit, right? Whether it's 100, then you have to literally tell that dude, like, when the season ends, like, you're coming to spring training as a starter. Otherwise, like, it's probably not possible, right? Like, he can't, like, train all offseason as a reliever. and then you come trying to start. The thing that's funny about it is, like, we've talked about, like, whether they're babying guys or whatever, like, maybe that's not fair. But, I mean, like, Noah Schultz and Sean Burke look fine right now, throwing six innings in the big leagues, like, every week. Like, they can suddenly just do it. Like, Schultz was, I mean, even 2 years ago, it's like, he'd throw three innings in Birmingham and strike out six dudes, and we're like, oh my God, this guy's great. And you get all the questions, like, oh, when's he going to pitch more? And now he's in the big leagues, and it's fine. It's just like, okay. Like, and look, there's an innings limit probably, right? Like, for Schultz, too. But he's been so efficient that it doesn't matter. I mean, Sean Burke was another guy who spent a ton of time hurt, didn't rack up a bunch of innings in the minor leagues. And, like, I don't think they're going to shut him down anytime soon, right? So, I mean, if Sean Burke's good, he's going to throw 140-plus. So, I mean, maybe it'll just be fine. But, yeah, like, some of the it's pretty puzzling to me, you know? And then, you know, it's pretty clear, like, some of the pitching stuff. Like, Anthony Kay very clearly, like, needs an opener, in my opinion. I know he doesn't, like that, and that's not what he, like, signed up to do. But he can't get righties right now, like, at all, you know? And he kind of got around it today, and he was a little bit better today. So, you know, I do think there might be some usefulness. Like, if he moves into, like, a multi-inning, like, relief role, like, from the left side, I think he's still, like, useful. I just don't know. Like, right now, it's, like, looks a little bit tough.
Yeah. I know what I say to this, but what do you say about this? Tom says, I don't know about Taylor. He looked bad the second inning Saturday. He might really be just a great reliever.
Yeah, I saw that all over, like, Twitter, too, where people don't think he can start because of that. I just like, think it's a weird role. I think if you tell that kid he's a starter, like, he'll pitch differently. He'll prioritize different things, right? He'll be very fastball-heavy as a starter.
Yeah. My point is, if you're going to make him into a starter, you have to put him into these situations so he can work his way through them. Because he's going to run into innings that he doesn't have his best stuff,
yeah,
and he's going to need to learn how to work through it.
Yeah, I know.
So just automatically saying, well, I guess he can't handle it. I guess he's just a one inning pitcher when he goes out in his first innings, like, eight pitches.
I know. You know? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, his usage is, like, all over the place.
Yeah. So before Jeff gets here, let's talk about this shortstop first pick strategy for the White Sox. We got Jacob Gonzalez. We got Colson Montgomery. We're probably going to have Rock Chalowski more likely than not. You got Caleb Bonnemer, you know, in a later round, but I mean, they keep on amassing all these shortstops. Your thoughts on these on this strategy as an overall theme for the draft?
Yeah, I mean, they're never gonna have too many, right? Nobody's ever had too many shortstops because they can play everywhere. I do think it's funny, like, you see the people that are like, oh man, they're gonna have so many players, where do they all play? It's like, let's relax and just see, like, who's good and who's not good, you know? Ben Badler has a tweet, I know you saw it, like, about a shortstop out of the Dominican Republic that they're signing in January. Like, sign all the shortstops in that market, please, and thank you, you know? But no, I mean, the impetus for this was, like, I had a tweet about this. Like, as cool as it is to have Munetaka Murakami, and it's fun. Like, he's pretty good. And they spent money on him, right? So they should spend more money. That would be great. The fact that the White Sox, it looks like, and look, I know we're 105 games in, looks like they've developed a high school first rounder, like, into a star player. I mean, like, Colson Montgomery's got 30 bombs in 100 games. And if you look at defensive metrics, he's, like, one of the five best shortstops in baseball right now. Like, that dude's awesome. And
so why are we trying to move him off shortstop already?
I know. That's what I mean. I keep seeing that. But it would be a while, right? Like, if he moves to third because Rock Chalowski's better than him, great. Like, that would be awesome. But no, I mean, they shouldn't move him right now. He's awesome. Like, Colson's awesome. I think that's, like, I don't know. Do you think it's, like, going under the radar a little bit how good he is? Because I kind of felt like it was. Like, I get, like, the Mooney mania thing. But, like, this is, like, what we've wanted for a while. And I know, like, you know, they had Tim Anderson, and he was a JUCO guy. But, I mean, like the White Sox, who were an org that struggled with hitting development, took a first rounder, former basketball player from small town Indiana, and he's going to be like a 5-WAR player in the big leagues, like in his first full season. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I find it pretty odd that, you know, people are assuming that Billy Carlson or Rock Chulowski or, you know, even to a much lesser extent, Caleb Bonimer, are going to displace the one of the top defensive shortstops. I mean, I didn't see that part coming. I've always said, from what I saw from his lateral movement and the fact that he played basketball and was going to go play at Indiana on a scholarship on the basketball squad, I pretty much figured that he would be fine at shortstop. I did not, however, see the top five shortstop in Major League Baseball thing coming at all. But you're also assuming that these guys are going to be able to hit well enough to make it to the major leagues, number one. And number two, then they're going to be better than Colson Montgomery to the point where they're willing to move him off of a position that he's already probably going to have had for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. But I mean, he would be one of the best defensive third basemen in baseball.
Possibly. I mean, like there is definitely a difference in the position though. And like it, you know, when you are a shortstop, there's footwork that's involved. When you're a second baseman, there's footwork that's involved. But when you're a corner infield, it's reactionary. And I'm not saying that Colson wouldn't be able to handle the reactionary aspect of the position, but it's a very different position.
Yeah.
I think that also need, you know, that has, should, people should have that in mind when trying to just automatically move somebody to a different position.
Well, I don't think either of us thought he was going to be this good defensively, but both of us kind of thought he was, I always thought he was going to be fine. So it was always funny to me, the people you could tell that like didn't watch him that were like, oh, he's definitely moving because he's too big or whatever. Every time, yeah, I watched him, I thought he was fine at shortstop.
Yep.
So.
Yes, indeed. Well, we have a guest that has made his way into the lobby here, and I am going to go ahead and try and get him sorted here in put him nicely into his little box here on the screen here. Hopefully that works. All right. Almost. Bear with me here, folks, because
yeah,
this is always an adventure trying
to
get
Charles,
this thing sorted.
Charles is talking about a center fielder. It's the one thing that, like, you know, you don't see imminently. So, yes, they probably are going to have to draft one, trade for one, or sign one at some point. Because I don't necessarily see, you know, like, and my guess is when Braden Montgomery comes up, he's going to play some center, but I don't think he's a long-term center fielder.
All right. Let me just go ahead and hop into here.
What's up, Trey?
There's our guest, Mr. Jeff Ellis. How are you tonight, Jeff?
You know, I'm doing well. You know, I was listening to your conversation. I always think it's interesting to hear, because I know we talk about center field all the time, because that's just such a hard position to fill for any team right now. Arguably, even harder than catcher, weirdly. So, you know, just enjoyed listening to you guys talk. It's always fun to talk baseball, and always fun to talk with you all here, and great to talk draft in general too.
Yeah, I don't know how much you've been watching. I mean, obviously, like, Munetaka Murakami is the talk of like this fan base, right? And rightfully so. Like, spend money, that's what we were saying. But, you know, the fact that 105 games into Colson Montgomery's career, he looks like what he looks like, it's, you know, I think it's the bigger win for the organization as a small town Midwest kid with 30 homers in his first 105 games.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm one of the ones you can make fun of for not thinking he would stick at shortstop. I just, you know, I think I saw that one rough year, because I think I wrote him up like 3 years ago at Baseball Prospectus, where like it was the year he got hurt and he had the back issue, right? Was it? I can't remember what the injury was. And that was the year that was really rough. So I do, if anyone wants to go and dig out, they can find me being one of those who kind of doubted him. But I feel like it was a year he missed a lot of time with injury. And I'll say that was my excuse, was a limited sample. I can't remember what year that was. But yeah, you know, Murakami is so much fun. And, you know, I talk about how there's like certain bands guys fall in onto Savant, and it's like, yeah, he might miss a lot, but when you have barrel, hard hit, chase, and walk where he is, it's fine. It works. Like, sometimes we get a little too in the weeds, and again, I was probably guilty of that with Murakami, but I agree, when you get an up the middle guy who's doing what Montgomery has, that is 100% the win. And, you know, maybe you have another Montgomery-esque guy with Bonmer, who is a guy who I, at one point in time, had as the top prep player in that draft class, and then he had a rough spring, and I let myself get talked out of it, and one of my big regrets is not sticking with what I saw, you know, for about 3.5 years and letting myself fall in with everyone else, because it felt like, no, you know, I guess the last month, you know, the last 3 months matters more, and, but yeah, it's, you know, the White Sox are in a good, fun position, I would say, right now.
Yeah, Bonnemer was definitely divisive. Like, I remember, you know, like, I just, those conversations were interesting, like, right after the draft.
Yeah, I mean, they bet on tools and bet on the fact that, you know, sometimes cold weather kids take longer, and it's hard to not be excited with what you've seen with him so far, defense or not, you know, wherever he might end up. Like, the bat looks like a lot of fun.
So to me, I mean, the Guardians seem as pesky as always for you, right around 500. You're probably a little bit more frustrated about it, I would imagine. But, you know, just Chase DeLauder, Travis Pizana, that's fun. How are you feeling, like, so far and then going forward?
You know, the interesting thing is they're doing all of this with Stephen Kwan being really bad. Like, there's no other way around it. Like, Stephen Kwan has... So Stephen Kwan, if anyone who like really digs deep on the Guardians, it's like he's a first half only player. The second half, he has struggled to hit his body weight almost the last 2 years. But he's typically great in the first half, and they just haven't seen that. So that's rough. And Jose is having arguably, you know, the numbers are okay, but they're not like Jose, right? You know, this is not a guy who looks like the best third baseman on the planet, which is what he's looked like for like half a decade now, if not more. So the fact they're 500 with Jose and Kwan, who are, you know, the studs of this team, struggling, and Cade Smith was, I think, inarguably their third best player, also came out not looking great this year. It's kind of amazing in that regard. You know, the starting pitching has really helped carry them. And then, you know, you talk about what DeLauder has done early. Bizana had a nice weekend. But it's guys like Angel Martinez who look like they've kind of taken a step forward. I don't know how much what Schneeman has done is sustainable. But, like, a lot of their young guys are kind of moving forward in the right directions, and that's what's kind of made this a lot more easy to tolerate.
DeLauder actually being healthy probably helps a little bit, huh?
Yeah. I mean, he's on pace for... I mean, I don't think he's ever had 60 games. Like, you know, I think his best season ever is, if you look at total games, the year he was healthy in the Cape, and then he played like 20 games at James Madison. I think 57 is his minor league high. So I don't know if it can sustain. The fan base gets mad at me every time I bring up the injury history, but it's hard to ignore it. But as long as he's healthy, you know, I'll be quiet and let people make fun of me. Because I mean, as a fan of the team, it's fun to see him perform. Like, you know, I would rather be wrong about his health history than right. Like, I don't want to be right about an exciting hitter never being on the field, just in general about baseball. I mean, especially on the team I root for, but for any team, I want the exciting guys out there. I don't want him hurt.
You're talking to two gentlemen who had Luis Robert, Yoan Moncada, and Eloy Jimenez on their squad for a while. We know all about injury issues and guys with just living on the injured list for year after year after year. So, you know, hopefully he can stay healthy because he's a heck of a player.
Yeah, he's just a lot of fun. He's got a different look. The Guardians love to chase. I have to laugh. They love to chase unicorns because they have, like, Jose, who's no one's like him. DeLauder's got his weird swing. You know, Kwan isn't in his own way. They just keep going for these high-risk guys. And you know,
yeah, Jace LaViolette. Yeah.
Yeah, Jace LaViolette. I mean, I did some deep research, and I won't lie. I had AI help me because I was trying to find anything, and I bought a subscription to Baseball Cube because I like using Baseball Cube, and I should support him anyways. But I found the best hitter with a strikeout rate north of 25% in their junior or sophomore year, or, you know, in their draft eligible year was Ryan Howard. And then after that, it's Rami Gonzalez. And then, like, that's it. That's your list. So Jace LaViolette is a heck of a gamble for this team. But even like Daniel Espino, talking about guys who were hurt, who, I mean, I think any of us who followed that draft year ago, this guy's going to get hurt. I don't think any of us expected to be this long, but like, they love to gamble when it comes to the draft. They gamble like, you know, they don't gamble anywhere else, but boy, do they gamble on draft picks.
And Romy Gonzalez is 18th round, so it's a little bit different, you know?
Yeah, I think Howard was like the fourth or fifth because he had just a miserable junior year at Missouri State. But yeah, it's just like somewhere I have the list. I sat there and used Baseball Cube and had AI scour the internet in case I was missing something. But, you know, there were not great examples. I was trying to think of even some of the recent guys who were undrafted.
It's like Vance Honeycutt, right? I can't.
Yeah.
I can't get there. It's not going to work.
No, and people loved on draft night. They got really mad at me, which fine. Yeah, I understand. Cleveland has not had power hitters, people excited for the pick, and I was very negative. That's fine. I understand people disagreeing with me. You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to be excited. I just give my perspective. And people were like, Aaron Judge. I'm like, guys, Aaron Judge was like a 21%. Kyle Schwarber. I'm like, guys, Kyle Schwarber was a 12% strikeout rate at Indiana. Like, you got to understand, these guys were not, that's why 25% is a separator. Like, this is not what they did in college.
Yeah, and you killed him pre-draft, too.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
I was
you're not gonna change your tune because he's a guardian like on draft night, you know.
No. I mean, I had him in the 40s. It was not my favorite selection. If it works out, great. Him and Schubart were two guys where I wanted nothing to do with. So of course, my team drafted both of them. But I get it. Like, to a degree, I understand, because if you look at those two guys, they're like Murakami, right? They are the they don't chase, they walk, they hit the ball hard, but they're gonna miss a ton in the zone. But typically, even those guys are better in college with it.
You do me a favor, and just because, for my own peace of mind here, Matt Wilkinson. How's he been?
He's been really good. He had two starts this year in a row where he had a no hitter, like through that he got taken out. So he had about like almost 11 straight no hit innings. He hasn't added much. He hasn't. I didn't have him as a top 30 prospect in the system. Neither did Justin, my co-host. And at the risk of sounding a little egotistical, I don't think there's anyone out there who's really diving into the minors. Not even as much as me, but I would say my co-host Justin. Like, no one is spending more. Like, I would say Justin is the foremost expert in baseball in the Cleveland Guardians minor leagues. And I feel comfortable saying that. I'll brag for him. He spends more time on it than anyone I know. So he didn't see him as a top 30 guy. You know, he looked great in the World Baseball Classic. He keeps overachieving. I want to see it in AAA, because we've seen guys like Will Dion come up and do this throughout the lower minors. And then AAA, you use the different baseball. For people who don't know, like, it's a different baseball until you get to AAA. It's the same baseball they then use in AAA in the majors, and it's got a different feel. I know when we talked with Logan Allen, he said it's almost like more slick. It can be harder to handle. You don't get as good of a grip. Your stuff sometimes plays down because of it. And we'll see there. Like, I think he's got a real chance as a reliever. I think he's got a chance to be a big league pitcher. And I mean, he'll be a folk hero as a lefty out of the pen, and I think that's probably what he is. Maybe there's more.
I don't know if that's why he's going to be a folk hero.
He's going to be a folk hero because of his body and build, but I think that is your best route to him being a major leaguer and a folk hero, you know, because he's going to sit there and look like me out there thrown from the left side. I mean, at, you know, barely over 6 feet, and I think when he was drafted, he was 265, 270. Like, the tugboat nickname definitely fits. For him, he's fun. Like, I want him to prove me wrong. Like, it's the same thing I tell our fan base all the time. Like, I might be negative on guys, but I would love to be wrong, because a lot of these guys are fun. It's the same thing when people got really mad about John Kenzie Noel, and I'm like, oh, with his chaser, like, I go, this is never going to work. But I'm like, I want him to prove me wrong. He's a great guy. I only heard positive things about his attitude, a teammate, his work ethic. It's just hard to overcome swing decisions at a very basic level. So it's like, I always want these guys to prove me wrong. And Cleveland, basically, since I would argue Carson Tucker, and not that he did anything massively bad, he just, but reports we heard is he just didn't show up. He kind of quit on the team. And then Ethan Higgins is the last guy who had negative reports, really negative stories in the minors with this team. Since then, like, they have gone for A-plus character on all of their picks. So pretty much every guy I could sit here and say really positive things about, because that's something they're going out of their way to target.
Something we deal with here a little bit before we get into the draft, and like also partake in because of a decision that was made on draft night. What do Guardians fans think right now about Bazana over Weatherholt and Connor Griffin?
You know, it depends on who you're talking to. There are people who honestly have been hoping Bazana fails because they didn't like the pick from the beginning, and they want him to fail so they can be right. Because they didn't take Condon, and Condon is finally looking good, but I gotta be honest, Condon struggled as much as, you know, Bazana, if not more at points. And Bazzana cut them a sweetheart deal. He wanted to come to Cleveland. He wanted to be the top overall pick, and they saved so much money on him that they got Chase Mobley, basically paid him the equivalent of a second rounder. They flipped that Bazzana money and got themselves a bonus second rounder. Now Mobley has had some struggles, so it may not work out. That's always the risk with any prep arm. But, you know, there is a selection of the fan base, and it's hard because Nick Kurtz put up that huge year, and everyone's so excited for Connor Griffin, where they don't even want to, like, we hear so often about Connor Griffin, and I'm like, guys, have you looked at his struggles? Like, he struggled in spring. I haven't looked at him this week to see if maybe he's rebounding, but it's not like early on, unless I'm wrong, that he had, you know, torn the cover off the ball. Like, he was closer to average. So it's like, you know, and Bazzana, he had a nice weekend. He's having those moments, but there's definitely some, a set of the fan base just wants him to fail. They do not want him to be successful. They view it as like, you know, this front office never does anything right. Like, this front, there's a subset of the fan base that always comments negatively on everything the front office does. And when we say, hey, this team makes the playoffs almost every year, they're like 40% of the league makes the playoffs. I'm like, you know, I think the front office has done a pretty good job. I think most teams would take this front office with its success level. So I would say there's the people who are like buying on him long term, and then there's the people who want him to fail, and then there's those who are like, we passed on the top prospect in baseball. We passed on the rookie of the year. But at the same time, like, I'm sure you run into this with the, as White Sox, you know, writers, it's like no one was taking Nick Kurtz where the White Sox or the Guardians were drafting. He had a down junior year. He had some struggles. No one was saying take Connor Griffin there because Mississippi, you know, Mississippi prep players, we've seen a great increase in the past few years, but there was a lot of concerns with his swing and miss in his game. And he had to do a whole swing change to get where he is. Like, it's such unfair looking back. And like, we're not even, I don't even think you can do a redraft until you're 5 years out. And even then you still have to provide the context. Like, people might get mad about Hagen Smith and where he is relative to the rest of the class, but like, that was a pick that made sense in that range. Like, honestly, like, I was not a Jack guy because of the huge chase rates. Like, Hagen Smith, Braden Montgomery, you know, Weatherholt. I mean, Weatherholt was probably my highest guy with Smith at that point in the draft, right? Weatherholt went 7, unless I'm wrong. But like, it feels unfair to really get too negative to me with either of those selections where they went.
Yeah, like, one of the things that we wondered about with Connor Griffin is we wondered if the White Sox were in a place where they could help Connor Griffin make that swing change and still be successful. We don't know that if the White Sox draft him. I mean, now with Fuller here, we kind of feel a little bit more confident in the White Sox ability to develop hitters. But at the time that draft happened, you know,
that's a great point.
The whole reason they were rumored to pick Hagen Smith is because they knew that they needed to hit on that first round draft pick in Getz's draft. So they decided to pick the left-handed pitcher where they've had success.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, too. I mean, that's like, not to risk riling your listeners, but it's like, it's been a joke on our show. Like, you, no one got poor betting on hitters coming that the White Sox let go. It's like, you know, Gavin Sheets has been great with the Padres. Robbie Gonzalez, I mean, he's been, for a guy who's free, he's been okay. Great. Let's be honest.
Yeah,
for,
yeah,
like, a free guy, like, Robbie Gonzalez was basically let go, and he's been useful. Like, you know, Andrew Vaughn improved. Like, for a while there was definitely a developmental struggle. And I think we see that. And I think that's fair. And I think that, like, I think it's a really good point I hadn't even thought about until you brought it up here. But I agree with you. I think that's been where, and I see someone says Gavin Sheets hasn't been great. A year ago, he was league average, which for a Padres team that has no depth was a lifesaver, honestly.
And for him, that was a stark improvement from what he was here, yeah. what he was when he was here.
So. And I haven't looked at him this year. I'll say that. I'm talking out from last year's data, if I'm, yeah. Again, I know I'm risking upsetting your listeners.
Yeah, but, no, you're good.
But, you know, I think it's a great point that you bring up. I do think, like, their development was rough.
So you stumbled into my Twitter tirades and debates this week, Jeff, so I, like, reached out to have you on. So just, like, for me, there are, like, very few people that we would have on this early to talk about the draft, right? And, you know, like, they pick number one, so they have to talk about it on, like, local radio stations occasionally. And, look, like, people just don't know anything about the baseball draft or how it works, right? Even, look, Bob Nightingale, I read Bob's Sunday Notes column every Sunday because there's great stuff in it, right? But he's not the guy that I'm getting MLB draft info from because it's all agent-driven and... So essentially, like, what happened this week, like, he put out, you know, whatever, like, the nonsense about how, like, Rock might not want to come to the White Sox and the White Sox aren't settled and whatever. Like, it's all a bunch of nonsense, but it's also April, right? So I guess when you saw some of that stuff, what was your, like, initial reaction to it?
I just kind of looked at it as, so if we are really honest about baseball and reporting, and I say this as someone who has technically a reporting job, a lot of breaking information and a lot of these relationships aren't based on team connections, it's agent connections, right? So when I see stories like this, I look at agent connections first and foremost, and I think that's where Bob Nightingale gets most of his information. I could be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I will apologize. But I think, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like Rock is part of that Wasserman group that has like five guys at the top. They own this draft. Like, it's no team owns this draft. The Wasserman group owns this draft. And the more they can float, the more they're going to push, because last year's draft at the top was not good. Like, the White Sox picked a great year to have their penalty. Like, that was the perfect year to have the penalty. Eli Willits went first overall, and I laugh because, like, he's got no power. Like, you're looking at a guy, like, at first overall who has such a low relative ceiling, in my opinion, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but it's like he's this contact speed defense guy, and that's not what you're used to seeing, you know, first overall. Even, like, I know people say Bazzana didn't have great power, but he had elite exit velocities in college. Like, there was more potential for that. Last year's group didn't set any records. Rock Chalowski wants to set records with his bonus. I think he's looking somewhere between 10 to 11 is probably what their Wasserman is hoping. Wasserman also needs to set records to get more players, right? They want to be like, hey, we not only did we set a bonus, we set the bonus. We made a huge jump. And I think, you know, there could be some degree of them trying to help move and navigate things around. And, you know, the other thing right now is a few players have not stepped up the way I think everyone hoped they would. So the big group that, like, even a few weeks ago, I would have said, oh, I have an easy top five, easy top six. To me, it's kind of a top three. And then there's a fourth guy. And then five to about 15 is about the same. Like, that's how I kind of view the class right now, as I've been slowly going through it, finding the, you know, publicly available data, looking at video, pulling stats, looking at, like, high level competition rates. So that kind of makes it trickier because you can't spread that bonus out as much. And, you know, the trying to manipulate for a team is harder because there isn't that player you can necessarily play off each other because of how many of those top guys are Wasserman clients. So you can't even play them off each other.
Well, the first two definitely probably, yeah. In Emerson and Chalowski.
But, you know, if they take Rock, he's going to sign. And, you know, yeah, they're not going to take him without basically knowing what his ask is. Like, the last time I heard of, you know, occasionally get the weird ones where, like, Angel Cervantes told teams he wanted to go to UCLA and the Pirates ignored him. And the last guy, you know, where I remember it was a big deal was, like, Jude Fabian, where, like, Boston tried to play hardball and he just went back to school and then got the same money the next year from Baltimore. We don't see it at the top of the draft, and we won't see that positioning at the top of the draft. Like, this is all, it's posturing. Like, let's be honest. It's a lot of posturing right now for Rock to try to set a new high for bonus, for the White Sox to try to, you know, combat that, because it's important to spread that bonus around. Like, that ability to come back in round three or four and have that extra money from the top overall pick to maybe get some guys who've slid on boards. You know, teams always want to position themselves to go get the top talent all over.
Yeah, it's something that we've tried to, like, talk to people about, is the fact that I don't think people realize the bonus record is, like, $9.3 million, right? Like,
yeah.
They, like, even on local radio here, like, Bruce Levine is, like, one of the insiders, right? And Ian, he said, oh, yeah, Rock will sign because, you know, he's going to get $11.3 million. And it's like, no, he's not. Like, he's just not, you know? And it's, like, and that's just one of those things that we've kind of been. And, you know, Jeff, even if it's 10, he breaks the record by 700,000 and the White Sox pocket 1.3. I mean, that's, you know, it's, like, totally fine. And my guess is that, you know, I think it's Joel Wolf that's representing the top two guys, like, at Wasserman. You know, he's probably going to break the record at 1 and 2, I would imagine.
Yeah. No, it's like 9.25 is the highest. And I would bet both, you know, when it's all said and done, Rock and Emerson both end up north of 10. Like, I think they're both in that situation where those guys want to reset the market. And, you know, no one last year, like, was it, because it's still Burns and Condon, and then Skeens and Cruz, I think, are the top ones. I don't think Willits or anyone came close a year
ago. Burns and Condon are the record. So, but even with that, then, though, like, if you're the White Sox, like, what's the justification for going much higher than that?
I guess it's only if a team below is like, we'll give you 10. We'll
sure.
Give you 10.5.
But then you can sign for this or go back to UCLA.
you don't want to lose the year, right? Like that just, yeah. But hey, you know, sometimes it works out. Like,
and you don't want an unhappy player either.
No,
so
you don't. So a classic case of another example the other way is like Houston Astros, right? They don't sign Brady Aiken when he gets hurt. Because they don't sign Brady Aiken, it allows them to come back the next year and get Kyle Tucker and get Alex Bregman. And that bonus money that they got, they then used for Daz Cameron, which brought him Justin Verlander, which along with trash cans brought him a World Series or two. So, you know, it's sometimes, you know, those situations of waiting a year, it's not always the worst thing. But I do love the local media touches because I know the year Cleveland had the top overall pick. Local media here, I love to talk about, well, you know, Cleveland's a small fan base. They're not going to spend their money. They won't pay. They're going to go cheap. They're going to cheap out, not understanding that every single year Cleveland spends over their max. But, you know, it's like local media just likes to look at, you know, the angles in the way that they present it. Like it's free agency,
yeah.
You know, when it's not.
Ian, that happened this week. So that was like one of the things on local radio was that, you know, people here thought that the White Sox talked to Bob Nightingale and that was their way of like letting the fan base down nicely because Jerry Reinsdorf doesn't want to pay Rock. It's like they spend up to the 5% every year, like for the last decade. Like that's the one area where they spend a ton of money is in the draft.
Yeah, them in Cleveland. And them in Cleveland kind of have had a similar draft identity these past few years, I feel like, with some of the Cape Cod performers and some of the cold weather players, though you guys obviously mine your backyard a lot more. Cleveland hasn't had an Ohio kid in forever and a day, and Chicago has done a great job of mining the state of Illinois, which has just been a rising state in baseball in general. I feel like when I'm like going through and I think back to when I started doing this, Scout hired me in 2013, I would often kind of skip over Illinois. Like there was not as much there at the time. And now you've got 4 to 5 interesting players a year. So it makes sense for them to mine their backyard. And I'm sure they will. Like, I'm sure they're going to get a few more high school kids from Illinois this year before that draft is all said and done. And hopefully it's going to be because of them getting some extra money, figuring out the situation. And I'll say this, like, Grady Emerson's profile is not dissimilar to Rock's. Like, Rock had more speed. Emerson has a little more consistent power. But when Rock went to the combine, he showed those elite exit velocities. That kind of made him shoot up my board a little bit. Now, I still had him, like, 28th, 27th because I hadn't had as much. But, like, Emerson is not dissimilar. Now, it's a riskier thing to go that way, but, like, it's a lot riskier, and they're going to also have to deal with the blowback of not taking Rock because he's going to be the name. But, like, I have Rock head and shoulders above the group because of the risk. Don't get me wrong. But I can also understand if someone decided that they liked Emerson more, I can understand the logic even if I won't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, the thing that turns it for me is you're not going to save that much money on Emerson, right? Like, if you're if Emerson's $8.5 million, then I mean, now we're talking, right? But he's also going to get, like, close to 10 at number one. So the thing that I've been saying, Jeff, and, you know, is it's just really hard to, like, how high does somebody else's ceiling have to be for you to pass on the floor that Rock provides? I mean, it's just, you know, like you're Chris Getz, right? And like, you don't want to think about this from the perspective of ownership or the perspective of the marketing department, but I'm telling you, like in this case, like it absolutely matters. Like when the White Sox think they're going to be decent and you can put Rock Chalowski on the 27 team potentially by midseason.
Yeah, and especially for, I think, a team that has alienated some of its fans with some of the decisions and some of the ways things have gone. I totally understand that point of view 100% of like you do kind of have to win on multiple levels. And it would be you're going to have to basically if you take Emerson, the added pressure on that kid is going to be so high. And the game's already I know people would be like, it shouldn't matter. You know, guys should be able to deal with pressure. But why make it harder on anyone? Like, why make it intentionally a more difficult situation? So just take the best player. Everyone sit down, figure it out. Give him the highest bonus of all time so he can get that. But figure out where you can make this work. And I don't think, again, why would he not want to go to Chicago? As a Guardians fan who follows the Central, we just talked about Montgomery's success. We talked about Bonmer and where he has come as a second-round pick. You can look at some of the hitting successes. You can look at some of the players they've done. This isn't where it was 5 years ago. This is not a White Sox team where I would understand someone like Rock Chalowski wanting to avoid them. Like, again, hopefully no one gets mad at me, but I would have understood it a few years ago, but it doesn't make sense now. Now it just feels like posturing because,
yeah.
I mean, frankly, the White Sox have a fun young core. They have a lot of young players coming up. They've done a really good job of developing hitters and pitchers, and we're seeing them start to hit in their waves right now. So my whole take on the Bob Nightingale thing is it's posture, and it's, you know, trying to maximize a bonus more than anything else.
Yeah, Jeff, there were like rumors that he like grew up a Giants fan or something, which is like the impetus to it. But like, he's not getting to number four anyway. So that's that doesn't matter like at all.
And his dad was what, a Dodgers scout, right? Like,
yeah,
so
I think he might. I think he works for the Reds now.
Now,
yeah,
yeah. It's like, you know, but he grew up with a. I mean, not that we all followed our father's examples. I mean, I did at least. That's where my Cleveland sports dumb came from. But like, you can't tell me that like having Dodger stuff in the house didn't influence him a little. And he might have. But as I stated earlier, it to me, it's Chalowski, it's Vaughn, and it's Emerson. And then I like Flora a lot, but he's currently a 2.5 pitch guy, and anymore you need like 4 to 5 pitches. Like, you need a lot of pitches to be successful. So as much as I like Flora, you're going to have to do work. He's got to expand that repertoire something fierce. So that's why he slots in as kind of a solo four. So how does he get to the Giants pick? Like, that doesn't make – and I'd have to look at their pool, but their pool isn't going to be that great either. So are they going to punt their entire draft just to pay him all of their money and then take a bunch of senior signs? That's not going to set you up for success. That we know, no matter how good the player is, there's risk. And yeah, it just, again, this all feels like posturing.
So I do have a couple things here. So Will Gasparino, if he gets drafted by the Dodgers in, say, the second round, that one would not surprise me at all with his dad being there. But just a quick question, because I heard you mentioned the Cape Cod League earlier. How much should I weigh the lack of success that Rock had in the Cape Cod League?
You know, it's hard because it's a pretty, if I'm wrong, it was pretty limited and it was early on. You know, kind of like the same situation I want to say with Drew Burris as well, where it's kind of limited and early on. And the one thing I'll say is I do see teams kind of in general pulling back a little bit on the Cape Cod data because not as many guys are going, right? Like, it's great if a guy excels there, but Cleveland last year, for the first time in forever, didn't go with the Cape Cod star. Like, Jace Lavallette's not the Cape Cod star. That would have been Devin Taylor there. Like, that's the guy I'm like, oh, they'll take him, and they didn't do it. So we do see some pulling back on it, but, you know, Logan Hughes had a good year. Aiden Robbins was fantastic. Guys like that, you know, are kind of the guys that stand out. But I'm more concerned when it's a longer look and it's like their last season. So Rock doesn't concern me as much. You know, I don't remember it all off the top of my head. I'd have to pull. But, you know, for me, where he was, he spent so much time, you know, playing for, you know, various different levels during the summer, doing other things, that it was just, I think, after his freshman year, unless I'm wrong. And that's kind of, you know, we see guys kind of sometimes stink their freshman year and then get chances to do better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the literally the only knock that I've pretty much seen on him. That, and you know, that he's not the fastest guy in the draft. Which
funny, because he used to be plus his thing in high school was plus speed. I think that's the highest grade I gave a tool outside of defense. So it's just how things kind of change over time. But you know, it's better to thicken out and, you know, have that power, which is what he did. But yeah, I'm not too concerned. It's like I said, I'm going to have him and Drew Burris both in my top 10, and both of them were awful. I think that same year it was what? Let me look here now. In 24, I think Burris was also awful. I'm more concerned when it's like I'm going to get the name wrong. Carson Tinney, not Cooper Tinney, I think, but Tinney, the catcher from Texas, who was terrible last year. Like, that's when I'm worried. When it's like when you are the junior, when you are the older player, sophomore into junior year, like his data has me concerned. That's the guy I'm concerned about with his performance. I'm not as worried about those younger guys.
So a couple things before we let you go here. So one of our guys, Adrian, just curious, if you have a favorite prep pitcher that you think the White Sox could buy down to 41?
You know, when I was going through the prep class, I am not always the biggest fan of prep arms in general. I always get a little bit, last few years, I get a little bit of a nervousness with prep arms. I'm typically kind of not looking at like a Bumilla or someone like that. I'm kind of looking more a little bit for safety. I do like, I'm going to butcher the name because I'm terrible at pronunciation, Wachner, you know, his dad was a big league pitcher who looked good at the NHSI. Is Kevin his dad or is he Kevin? You know, I liked him quite a bit as kind of more of a safer guy. I think Bowman is a lot of fun as a lefty. I think they could buy just about anyone down. Like, I don't think there is, you know, Rijos, Rojas is probably the top guy, but like you could debate. There's a debate on all these guys. It's a deep group. There's 10 or so really interesting prep arms. So I think they could find one, pick one, and they're all going to be about the same range for me for those 10 guys. I really got to, it's not a year, like I fell in love with Ryan Sloan in his draft year. Like that was a guy where I'm like, I'm putting my top 30 and I know I shouldn't do this because I should never put a prep arm in my top 30 again. Same thing with Hernandez last year. I'm like, I can't believe I'm putting him in my top 10. I said I'd never put another prep arm in my top 10. I don't have that guy this year, if I'm being honest. I don't have that
I think Seth Hernandez might be the best pitching prospect in baseball right now. So,
yeah.
It's pretty freaking good, man. So, going back to just, you know, you were talking about Rock, you know, as an Arizona prep, and you talked about how you liked Caleb Bonimer too. Two very different profiles, right? But
yeah.
How different did those guys rank, like, as high schoolers for you?
So, like I said, at the start of the year, I had Bonimer as, like, borderline top 10. And then I got a bit nervous because Michigan kids have not performed, if I'm being honest. And I get too reflective in that. And he had a rough year. I always liked the power. The power was always fun with him. The power was always the part where I'm like, I think this kid's going to have power. The question is, will he access it? And where is he going to play? Like, I was like, third base or outfield was just kind of where I immediately went. I didn't think he was a shortstop. He had a good arm. So I thought third base is probably, or like I said, or outfield. He was power over hit. And with Rock, he was hit over power because I hadn't seen too much power. And then he went to the scouting combine and posted some of the best exit velocities of a prep player. So all of a sudden, I'm like, crap, I got to reevaluate this profile. I did have him. It's not like I'm a genius at this. I had him behind Colin Houck, and that obviously hasn't worked. I had him behind Ralphie Gonzalez. Like, Ralphie's been good for Cleveland, but probably that's a bad ranking now in retrospect. Like, you know, I still had him pretty low, even at 29, relative to a lot of the other players, because the power wasn't quite as defined as it is now. I mean, we saw signs of it. We saw the exit velocities. And that's part of just me evolving and what I do, where, like, nowadays I'd be like, okay, so now I know what kind of the minimums are, what I'm looking for, and how much that stat matters, even at the high school level, that I probably should be giving it more weight to his growth potential with power.
You got anything else, James? All right. Well, Jeff, thank you for hopping over here on the Future Sox podcast. Do you want to let everybody know where they can find you and your content?
Sure. I'm, you know, over at Locked On Guardians, where maybe you guys don't want to hear Guardians content, but you can also find me on Twitter at JeffMLBDraft. When I do, every year I put out a big board, I put out some mocks. There'll be links in my profile. It's just me as one person. I do it very low key. So, but it's just some free content. If you want to go and get more on the draft, I'll have that out there. I share out. I like to do my own little corner of the internet, but, thank you for having me on.
Hey, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Have a great evening, everyone.
All right. All right. I'm going to go ahead and walk us out here, James. You good? All right. You have been watching / listening to the Future Sox podcast, part of the Just Baseball Media Network. If you are listening to this in podcast form, know that you can find us every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on the YouTube and the Purple app. You can also find this podcast along with all of our written content at futuresox.net. If you are looking for White Sox prospect highlights, you can now find them on our X at Future Sox and also here on our YouTube channel. If you love the content and want to support us here at Future Sox, there is a link to our Patreon in our channel description and at futuresox.net. You can also toss up a super chat on our YouTube stream. Also, don't forget to like this stream and subscribe with notifications so you know when we're going live while helping us in the World Wide Web algorithms. My name is Ian Eskridge at Daily White Sox. He's James Fox at JamesFox917. We appreciate all of you guys. Thank you so much for hanging out in the comments and in the chat. We appreciate you guys. You guys are the best. Thanks for helping us drive this thing. We appreciate you. Have a good week. We'll catch up with you guys next week. Good night.